voice of America.
What's next for African expatriate students who have returned home from Ukraine? War has upended their lives abroad and potentially put their futures on hold. This week, we'll look at what attracted so many African students to Ukraine's universities in the first place. Is this a sign of new study abroad destinations attracting students from the continent? Also, what is Africa's plan to entice its medical professionals abroad to return to the continent?
We cannot prevent people from moving, from migrating, but what we can try and do is create the ecosystem that will help retain the talent in-house on the continent.
My conversation with the former president of Mauritius about what African countries need to do to urgently reverse the so-called brain drain. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. It's great to have you with me. In recent weeks, we've been covering the stories of African students trying to escape the war in Ukraine. Some made it back to their home countries, and others are still trying to find refuge in places like Poland or elsewhere in Europe. With their lives upended and their futures at stake, many are wondering what will happen next. How and where will they complete their studies? Well, we spoke to students who have just returned home from Ukraine to find out how they've been impacted by the conflict in Eastern Europe and what is next for them.
Final year medical student from Ukraine, Dominik Oru, was 2 months short of completing his degree when Russian forces invaded Ukraine. Like hundreds of others from his city, he fled to Romania and returned to Nigeria in early March. Since then, Oru and his colleagues have resumed their classes online, but only after a reunion following their sudden departure.
So our major conversation was about how we didn't get to have a proper goodbye to each other, because we're thinking that, oh, we still had time, there was going to be the graduation ceremony where we're going to have like pictures and everything.
Still, Oru says he is keeping his hopes high despite worrying about his teacher in Ukraine, who is doubling as a frontline responder.
He looks really, really very stressed. He looked like he had had like very little amount of sleep. You could see the eye bags around his eyes. For my class, which I had on Monday, like about 30 minutes to the end of the class, he got a call and, of course, he excused himself.
Nigerian authorities said around 8,000 nationals were in Ukraine when the invasion began. About 5,000 of them were students. Freshman medical student Fatima Bafa has started virtual learning as well, catching up on her studies and with her friends. But for her, it's not the same.
So I really miss attending my physical classes, seeing my friends, my teachers.
Fatima's parents say she must stay out of Ukraine.
We can't take her back. We need the place that can she studies peacefully, because my daughter, she's so young. She's just 16 years.
Oru and his colleagues were planning a big dinner party to celebrate their graduation. But now he fears he may never see some of his classmates again. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Well, now, hearing the stories of international students caught in the war in Ukraine made us curious about what attracted those students, especially those from Africa, to the Eastern European nations' learning institutions. A study on student mobility by the international development consultancy Development Reimagined shows that China is fast becoming a major study abroad destination for African students. So what does this mean for universities in North America and Europe who have traditionally traditionally been top study abroad destinations for African students. Are they still attractive, or are there new players emerging, making higher education more accessible for students from the continent? And joining me now to discuss this are Abna Bwaiti. She's an educational consultant based in Princeton, New Jersey, right here in the United States. And in Washington is Anesu Masube. He's the founder of the nonprofit organization Opportunities for Zimbabweans. Anesu and Abna, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anesu, I'm going to start with you. Now, your organization is called Opportunities for Zimbabweans. Please tell us what you do and how you have helped students and professionals find opportunities, and which countries are the most popular amongst them.
Yeah, thank you so much. So Opportunities for Zimbabweans is an organization that I started about 6 years ago. It's an online digital platform that seeks to bridge the gap between young Zimbabweans that are looking for academic and professional development opportunities locally in Zimbabwe, but also in the region of the African continent, of course, starting predominantly with regional neighbors like South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, but also looking at scholarship opportunities across the continent in East Africa, in West Africa, in countries like Rwanda. But that also includes the rest of the world. So scholarships in Europe, scholarships in the U.S., as well as scholarships in Asia, in places like China and Australia. What it seeks to do is basically using social media as internet's accessibility starts to increase in the continent. We seek to use platforms like Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, to basically share all the opportunities that we find out there that young Zimbabweans and in a lot of times, young Africans are eligible to apply for. So I would say the organization so far has helped over 300 Zimbabweans to get opportunities across the world. And like I mentioned, that includes locally in Zimbabwe, on the African continent, but as well as global opportunities.
Abna, you work mainly with students as well, especially those interested in studying in North America, correct?
Right, correct. Mm-hmm.
So who's looking, for opportunities abroad, and what fields of study are they interested in?
Okay, so I mainly help students from Ghana who are seeking to study either in the U.S., the U.K., or Canada. And I also actually help students in the U.S. also. From Ghana, I would say most of them are, it's a combination between business, the liberal arts, and engineering, or STEM majors are actually very popular as well. And so these are mostly students from international private high schools. And we also have, I also help a lot of students also from the public sector high schools as well. Traditionally, those who attend the more private international schools are better prepared in a lot of ways because the entry requirements are a little bit more stringent, especially when seeking scholarships and financial aid in the U.S.
Anesu, as we continue to see students from Africa trying to leave Ukraine, and of course, none of us could have predicted or anticipated, you know, that war would break out. But what was so attractive about Ukraine's learning institutions in the first place, and particularly for students from African countries who, you know, as we've been talking, traditionally would go study abroad in the U.S. or in Europe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a number of factors that could attract African students to study in Ukraine. The first one, like you mentioned, countries like the U.S. and Europe can only take a certain number of African students, right? They can only take a small portion of students. So where do the rest of the students that are interested in studying abroad go? Of course, they end up looking at alternative options like Ukraine or China or some places within the African continent itself. So that's number one, just options. It cannot just be Europe and the USA. Other countries have these kind of similar opportunities and scholarships. Then the second one really is affordability. Studying in Ukraine and places like India and Russia is relatively cheaper compared to tuition fees here in the US or in Europe. And then you start thinking about the easiness of getting visas or student visas and things like that. You'd find that it's relatively much easier in those countries. Once you get a place in a university, you're almost guaranteed to get a visa. That's not usually the same case in countries like the US or Europe. And the third one is really young people are becoming increasingly interested in a global village, right? There is strength in power in having a diverse set of experience. So in as much as it is an advantage to study abroad in America, it's becoming also increasingly an advantage for an African who has also studied in a country like Ukraine, because they bring a diverse set of experience, which most global companies are looking for in terms of skills and experience from young people.
Abner, when you speak to students, are these factors like money, visas, are they major turnoffs and are they major drawing cards too? I mean, where does all of this leave the US or Canadian or European learning institutions? Are they still destinations of choice for African students looking to study abroad, in your experience?
I think they're still the first destination of choice. Although, like Anesu mentioned, cost is increasingly becoming a big barrier. It always has. And as it becomes more competitive, scholarships and financial aid is also, very competitive and is over the years has dwindled quite a bit. So as the cost starts to squeeze students out of the possibility of studying in the U.S., other places that are less expensive become more an alternative to consider. And I think that's kind of what you're seeing, especially with China and Ukraine, is that the cost is definitely something that is becoming more attractive. And as I said earlier, too, I mentioned that the entrance requirements are also still pretty stringent and rigorous in the U.S. I mean, getting into a U.S. college, you do need to have a pretty strong, academic record. You need to also typically take the standardized test, although now a lot of schools are waiving that. Especially over the COVID period, schools were waiving the SAT requirements, ACT requirements. However, other holistic qualities are also looked at, such as leadership qualities, extracurricular involvement. So the requirements are just so much more, and I think students just want a more straightforward path that's also relatively cheaper. And so then, these other areas become more and more attractive. And the quality of education in Ukraine and China are, in a lot of cases, just as good. So why not? If it's cheaper and more accessible. And as Anesu mentioned too, the visa requirement sometimes is quite a turnoff to students and families.
And it's worth noting the kind of economic wherewithal you need just to get to the United States, never mind your studies and your lodging. But Anesu, we know that now that universities, of course, also do profit from foreign students. And you've also been involved in exchange programs in countries like India and Russia. But what do these universities offer students, particularly from the African continent? What do they offer that one might not realize?
Yeah, I think just a different perspective to the world, right? Like, for the most part, I think the big benefits from studying abroad or exchange programs is that diverse set of experience that you get. When I did an exchange program in India, it really opened up my eyes, my world, because I did not know much about, how the Indian economy works, how technology is such a big thing in a place like India. And it just gives you, like I said, a wide set of understanding of the world and global economics and global politics. And I think this is very attractive, especially to young people who are interested in international careers. I see it here in Washington, D.C., at institutions like the World Bank or corporate companies that are global, like technology companies. They look for these students that have, experiences in not just one country or one continent. I think it's increasingly becoming a strength for anyone's resume that has experience not only from their country, but from another continent. So I think these increasingly become a sort of opportunities that young people and young students are interested in as most and most companies become global and look for this diverse set of experience.
Abna, for some, prestige is still a very big part of the learning institution, I guess, the one that they choose. Does a qualification from, say, the finest universities in places like India or Russia or China, for that matter, have the same kind of potential to open up opportunities as, say, a degree or postgraduate degree from Harvard or Princeton, MIT, or other any of the other prestigious universities here in the United States and in Canada, of course?
Well, I think it's definitely an advantage if you gain a degree from a well-known university, like say Harvard or Yale, because I mean, it's definitely, you know, whether we, you know, agree or not, it in general opens doors. And I would say that that's definitely one of the benefits or advantages to attending a university that is well-known and has a name, basically. So, in fact, a lot of students who do come that I help from, you know, Ghana, both in Ghana and even in the U.S., they are seeking the brand name, if you will, of a college, because those are the types of schools that do have, like, international recognition.
And let's not forget, I'm pretty sure parents like the big prestigious universities as well, of course. But Anesio, how big of a role does prestige play these days? And do you anticipate that that's going to change? And I also want to ask you whether the folks that you've worked with see an opportunity to study abroad as a gateway to finding a job or building a career in another country.
Yeah, I agree with Abner. Yes, you know, those places like Harvard, Oxford, or these big universities still carry such a big name and attractive, sort of prestigious. I personally do not agree with that, even though it's a fact, because not everybody can go to Harvard or MIT. There are 1.2 billion people on the African continent. If you take the percentage of Africans that can go to a Harvard, it's very, very tiny and small compared to the rest of the workforce that will actually fill in majority of the positions in those economies. So I tend to focus more on scholarships from universities that are less known because personally, that was my journey. I did not go to a Harvard or an MIT. I went to college in Zimbabwe. I did my master's at a small university here in America. And, you know, doing exchange programs in places like India and Russia. These are channels that majority of people easily become eligible to apply for. And a lot of people do not recognize that it's not only the 2% of students that can get scholarships, but a wider range of students can actually get some sort of funding, especially if you consider sort of alternative universities, simply because not everyone can go to Harvard or MIT. So it's almost one of the things we're trying to do at Opportunities for Zimbabweans is identifying these other opportunities or channels that are less known or less talked about, but that have helped hundreds and hundreds and thousands of students over the years. And most usually, once you get your master's degree abroad, it depends on what you want to get from it. Of course, the main one is getting a job right after. That could be locally or internationally. But also, we see a lot of people that are interested in going back to the continent and apply what they have learned, right? Depending on, of course, the economy of the country you come from, how available opportunities are locally to get a job, some even get into politics. There was a statistic somewhere I saw that a number of African presidents right now did an exchange program or a study abroad somehow in their career. I've forgotten the exact number, but even if you look at the leadership on the continent right now, you can see those trends of people that have either studied abroad, have traveled. So these things increasingly become sort of an attractive thing for any student who has the opportunity to gain some experience, whether it's through an academic scholarship or through an exchange program, even as short as a 2-week exchange program or 1-month exchange program. I think it's playing a very critical role in helping students get more opportunities than the ones that are just locally available to them.
Abner, given the situation right now in the world, apart from figuring out how and where to continue their studies for students who have had to leave Ukraine, there's also this psychological effect that this war has had on them. Here on our show, we've heard stories from students from Zimbabwe and from Ghana who were stuck in conflict zones in Ukraine. And they talk about the fact that they will probably never enjoy fireworks again, or every time a door closes, they jump. They, too, are now trying to deal with a trauma. What would your advice be to these students about what to do and where to go now for help, not just with their sort of educational well-being, but also their psychological well-being?
I think for a lot of students who've gone back home, one way they can actually keep up their skills and not lose track of what they were pursuing in the first place, like what took them to the Ukraine or wherever, especially, let's say, a medical student, when they go back home, they can seek opportunities where they can either, you know, work in hospitals or job shadow, or, you know, get involved in the medical field in one form or another, and don't lose hope. Continue if possible, if any of the institutions are doing any or offering any lectures online, to stay focused and continue with that. And then the other thing, too, then would be start exploring other countries, and also within Ghana or Zimbabwe itself, or wherever the students have gone back home. You know, keep seeking opportunities within the higher education institutions within, you know, their countries, respective countries. They will probably be able to, transfer or reapply. But I would advise them or encourage them to stay focused and not lose track of what they initially set out to do.
Anesu Masube and Abna Bwaiti, thank you so much for your perspective. It's great to speak with you. Thank you for joining us here on Straight Talk Africa. Thanks for your time.
Thank you
very much.
Well, we're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, the Africa Centers for Disease Control says it is working on a plan to entice Africa's medical professionals working abroad to come back to the continent. Is it realistic to think or hope they will come back? We'll speak to the former president of Mauritius about this. She says it all starts with investment. We'll be right back.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. The head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control, Dr. John Kengasong, wants Africa's medical professionals working abroad to come back to the continent. Dr. Kengasong says he's working on a plan to reverse what he sees as Africa's medical brain drain. He himself is poised to leave the African institution. If confirmed by the U.S. Congress, Dr. Kengasong will become the new head of the United States' signature global HIV/AIDS response program, PEPFAR, which stands for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Dr. Kengasong would be the first person of African origin to lead the program, by the way. But he says the COVID-19 pandemic revealed to him how rich nations are relying on African doctors and nurses to support their health services. It's estimated around 1,000 healthcare workers move to the United States every month from countries in Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean. Now, for some countries, Dr. Nkengasong's proposed initiative could not come soon enough. Nigeria loses thousands of doctors every year to Europe, North America, and the Middle East because of poor salaries, benefits, and working conditions in the West African country. Nigeria's health authorities are promising improved compensation to stop the country's medical brain drain. But is that enough to keep their doctors working in hospitals and clinics at home? Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
We didn't have the materials we needed to work with, so you would see people die from preventable diseases.
Nigerian Dr. Chimezie Ibe recalls the poor state of Nigeria's health system. When he got an offer to work in Britain 2 months ago, he took it.
I left because I got frustrated. I worked in an environment where for the first 4 months of my employment, I was owed. And in these 4 months, I had bills to pay, I had responsibilities to meet up to, I had to be at work every day.
Dr. Ibe is among the some 2,000 doctors Nigeria loses every year to better paying jobs abroad, according to the country's National Medical Association. Countries such as Britain, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Canada are prime destinations. The association says poor funding, frequent strikes, overpay, and unfavorable government policies for the health sector are to blame for the medical brain drain. Money is not the only factor driving health professionals abroad, as Nigerian optometrist Ifeanyi Ugeni explains.
I want to practice in an environment where I have basically all diagnostic tools at my disposal.
Payment disputes between the government and medical practitioners have continued for years and led to strikes, the latest being the National Association of Resident Doctors strike, which was suspended more than 2 months after it began. Nigeria's Medical Association blames the migration for Nigeria's falling doctor-to-patient ratio. But some doctors like Blessing Okubo refuse to leave.
Which I have had several opportunities to work abroad, but I still chose to strengthen my country and strengthen the health sector.
Nigerian authorities promised to increase pay in a bid to retain physicians. But medical expert Ejike Oji says a broader approach is needed to ensure Nigerian doctors stay.
But our healthcare system is so broken that we need a lot of resources. And we need a lot of transparency and accountability to make use of even the little that we want to put in it.
Until then, thousands of Nigerian health professionals will continue trying to get a job abroad. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that was Timothy Obiezu there reporting from Abuja, Nigeria. Well, earlier I spoke to someone who has long been advocating for ways to keep Africa's best and brightest professionals from leaving for opportunities abroad. She's a scientist, an academic, and the former president of Mauritius, Amina Gurib Fakim. She says investment in STEM is key to reversing Africa's brain drain. Dr. Amina Gurib Fakim, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining me here. Ma'am, the African Union estimates that about 70,000 skilled professionals emigrate from the African continent every year. You've been talking about this for years, ways to keep Africa's skilled professionals at home. If we look at the people leaving African countries today, and in terms of the kind of skilled professionals, who is leaving? And according to what you know, why are they leaving?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Heidi. It's always a pleasure to speak to Voice of America. You know, migration has always been, since mankind has existed, people have moved around. And I've migrated from my country to get an education overseas, at least a tertiary education, but I came back home. And unfortunately, this is the core that many people are adopting now. When they're moving for good. And it's a loss for the continent, there's no doubt, especially at a time when the continent needs all its resources, human capital and otherwise, for its movement. Having said this, we cannot prevent people from moving, from migrating, but what we can try and do is create the ecosystem that will help retain the talent in-house on the continent for our own gain. And I've just mentioned one word, the ecosystem which we need to build. And I think gradually Africa is rising up to this challenge, and there are pockets of such ecosystem which are being created on the continent, which will hopefully retain some of the talent. Unfortunately, it is something, a feature which is happening across the world. They're moving to America. If you look at, for example, the Silicon Valley, you find that over 40% of the talents, they come from India. So this is a challenge that most countries face. And if you look, fortunately, to a country like China, I mean, they have done fairly well by retaining and also bringing back its talent. So maybe there are lessons to be drawn there as how China has done it. But I wouldn't be far off to say that it's because they have invested in that space.
Migration is, of course, normal. And as you mentioned, countries like India, many other countries have this problem. The United States itself, has a brain drain too. But how much of this trend of Africa's young professionals leaving is normal, and how much of it isn't?
Well, we just have to look at some sectors. I mean, if you look at, for example, a country like Nigeria, Nigerians in the United States, they represent, I think, 1% of the entire diaspora of African Americans. And if you look at, for example, the intake at an institution like Harvard, for example, they represent 25%, I think, of the intake there in terms of the African Americans who are actually finding admission in a prestigious institution like Harvard. So, you know, it's where I think many countries are failing because they haven't invested in the higher education system. And I think this is, again, where Africa has to run before it can actually walk, because we need to play catch-up very fast, especially now we are talking increasingly about the fourth industrial revolution, where the investment, again, needs to be done. And hopefully, and I sincerely hope, that leaders are waking up to the fact that they need to put their hands in their own pocket to invest in the people, because by 2050, there will be about 1 billion young people who will be available for the world of work, and they would come from the African continent.
And to that point, Dr. Gurib Fakim, a recent article by Time magazine referred to what's happening as a global war for young talent. Africa, of course, as you just mentioned, has the world's youngest population. Do you agree that there is a global war for young talent? And how equipped is Africa as a region, really, to combat this trend?
I think we'll have to posit this global war for talent, especially now, as the countries are waking up after the COVID. And there has been recently, making the headlines, the Great Resignation. So I think people, major pandemics have always shaped the world of work. And right now, as we speak, because now we have the digital space to actually flag into the equation, I think we find that the war will be on for talents because they will be able to operate from elsewhere than the office space that they used to in the past. So this is a new paradigm that African countries have to actually cope with. And again, Africa, it will be sectoral, because if you look at countries like Northern Africa, they have understood. If you look at South Africa, they are understanding. If you look at countries like Rwanda, even my country, we're trying to invest in the digital space. So I think eventually the war, as you have mentioned, will be in the space, not just in the physical space of getting the talent to the laboratory, but also getting the talent even online. Who are those who are more tech savvy and who can actually respond to the need of the continent? So again, it's all about Africa investing in her own people. And that is going to be the challenge.
And of course, speaking about the pandemic, we also saw during COVID-19 that, or at least at the height of COVID-19, that there is this global demand for Africa's medical professionals, Africa's doctors, nurses, etc. And, earlier in the show, we were talking about how the outgoing Africa CDC director, Dr. John Kengasong, proposed an initiative to entice Africa's medical professionals to come back to the continent. Dr. Gurib Fakim, is it fair to expect people, or to hope that people will come back and leave behind lucrative, successful careers that they have built and sacrificed for in other countries? Is it fair to expect them to come back?
I think I will answer the question slightly differently. I don't expect the people who have, as you have rightly said, a lucrative career, you know, everything to go for them, for their families, for their children, let's say in Europe or in America, to come back to Africa. But what I'm proposing, I think increasingly is being accepted, is to have this brain circulation. That means we engage with the diaspora more and more, for projects. I mean, we don't expect them to come back, but I think what we would like to see, as I say again, is a wish, and I hope they actually take up this this desiderata from leaders in Africa, is to spend some time on the continent, and also to try and be that role model, and also to actually help those young people who are aspiring to become, you know, scientists, engineers, and give them a little bit of the time. So be that role model, and also try and take them by the hand so that they rise, and hopefully, like a country like Ghana, for example, they are attracting some of the talents back home. But again, it will all depend on the level of investment and also what are the incentives that the mother country is putting forward. Because I'm sure a lot of the talented Africans would love to go back, but provided they find something to do. So let us capitalize first and foremost on what I increasingly refer to as brain circulation.
Now, madam, of course, as the former president of Mauritius and in your capacity now, you travel a lot. You meet a lot of policymakers, government leaders. What is your sense about the approach that the African continent is taking here in order to attract professionals back? Is it a case of, you know, if we build it, they will come? Or should they come first so we can build it?
I think there is this awakening. You know, I again posit this within the framework, the post-colonial history of the continent, which is on average 60 years. So it's taken some time, there's no doubt. As I said, we have to run before we can actually walk. But I think there is this awakening that Africa has to cater for its own youth. And it's and in fact, if you look at the age gap between the leaders and the young people, we are talking about an age gap of over 50 or 60 years in some region. So we need to address this. We also need to see that Africa is the youngest continent. So there is the gradual awakening, but again, it is an issue that takes time. I mean, look at, for example, in some of the prestigious institutions we have in many countries in the West. I mean, it's taken years to actually grow. But having said this, there are some flagship institutions in South Africa, for example, and these universities, they appear within the first 400 among the best in the world. So we have to actually keep on investing in that space, invest in our people, invest in our ecosystem, and so invest in the young people, because no one will do that for us. And this is the message I've been taking to leaders across the continent, is that we need to invest in our own people. It's our responsibility first and foremost. So this is the only time that when you create that space, be it as entrepreneur, be it as incubators, provide them with venture capital, provide them with the angel funding. This is the time when they will translate their finding, their interests, their inventions into becoming that entrepreneur so that they can actually create jobs for more and more young Africans.
Seeing Africans doing well in other countries, and of course they're contributing to economies everywhere in the world, but seeing them do well is of course also a source of pride for the continent. So one feels a little torn. At the same time, you want to see your people on a global stage contributing sort of at that level. But at the same time, of course, we want to retain the best on the continent. As war broke out in Ukraine and we started seeing the number of African students, of course, trying to get out, but it did make one think about, wow, how many African students were studying in a country that one might not even think about? And then you start thinking how many more students are now all across the world. Did seeing those images, you know, elicit in you some concern that these are more people who might not return, whose education abroad might be a gateway to careers abroad?
Yes, I think many young Africans were tempted, and think they have studied in Ukraine. I think it provided quality education that met with their aspirations. And what we saw, in fact, today, this evening, we saw many Cameroonian students who are still stuck there, and they are sending pictures and, of course, videos from wherever they're staying through their mobile phone. So it's a crisis, and some Africans have managed to come up. But then again, if you look at a big country like India with about over 20,000 students there, again, getting them out of the country has come in a very, very small trickle. But unfortunately, we have also seen the crisis that some Africans who actually were fleeing through Poland, what they come up with. I mean, there has been some horrifying stories of, you know, you call it racism, you call it bias, whatever it is. So there is this they have to grapple with. But I agree that the message should have been listened to. I think the various countries might have issued the call for them to move out as soon as they heard that there were going to be, of course, rumblings of war. But we are where we are, unfortunately, and I hope that they come out, at least wherever they are, they stay safe. And if they can come out, I mean, I'm sure the embassies and the consulates will try and help them to the best of their abilities.
Ma'am, you co-authored an article for Brookings Institution in which you said that STEM is the key, and investment in STEM is the key to Africa's economic transformation. Please tell us what you mean by that, and why STEM? Because let me just tell you, you know, there are others who might not be good at science, you know, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I am one of those people. But what kind of opportunities are there also worth investing in for people who might not be inclined to go into those areas?
I would add also one more letter to the STEM. So science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. And then I would add another layer, we girls in STEM, girl in STEAM. Why I've put the A, because we are seeing increasingly, especially in the world of design, IT, where you need that artistic mind. Now, why do we need women in STEM? I'll just take one sector. I'll just take the sector of agriculture. This is the sector that is feeding the continent. We saw the problem of food security over the past 2 years during the COVID era. And I think if we look at agriculture, it's a $1 trillion business that Africans are sitting on. And Africa is a continent which actually is home to 60% of the world arable land. And why I mention agriculture, because it's something that people can understand very quickly, is that often the stereotype image that we have of agriculture on the continent is that woman with a hoe digging a very dry soil with a baby on her back in the hot sun. This is not agriculture. This is not how it's done in Africa. Granted that Africa's agriculture is 85% dependent on rainfall, being a rain-fed agriculture. So there are challenges. But I think if we bring in the technology, if we bring in the women who are empowered with the tools of technology, and for that to happen, she must have the modicum of training in the sciences at a very young age. So then she can become that entrepreneur, she can access capital, she can invest in the land, and provide food. And also, mustn't forget that the African continent has now the Africa Free Trade Agreement, which actually is operational since 2021. So that means that there is an internal market. So meeting the quality standards, quantity is there, and we should see through only one sector, agriculture, and more integration, so we can move beyond the paltry 18% of trade across the continent, if only for that sector we can increase by 40%. Now, just think of the innovation that can bring. When we transform the raw material, when we actually, and transformation of the raw material means innovation. So there is an entire supply chain that can be addressed, because who talks about agriculture talks about medicine. Through this medicinal plant that we grow, through this we talk about cosmetic product, raw material which actually go into cosmetic, shea butter, baobab oil, you know, all these. So there is an entire supply chain that can be addressed to create not just jobs, but also create food security, and also create an entire enterprise for these young people who are thinking about going in this field. But when we put in the technology, we take away the negative stereotype that agriculture has so far, and hopefully bring in the young people. And when we say bring in the young people, we of course go back to what we had said earlier on in terms of reducing emigration and migration.
Ma'am, may I just ask you to expand a little bit on something you mentioned earlier? You mentioned that China seemed to have had some success in attracting its talent back to the country. What are some of the lessons that you think that, the African continent can learn from that experience, or African countries can learn from that experience, that, could be sort of immediately implemented, or at least just at the start? And also, are there African countries that, in your estimation, are actually doing a good job of, at least trying to attract their talent?
The Chinese story is unique in as much as it started opening up to the world in 1978, of course, with the vision of Deng Xiaoping. And if you look at that country, which was, of course, very poor in 1978 when the country started opening up, to now, it's came out from the coal, and now, if you look at among the first 25 universities, you find two Chinese universities there. So there has been, important decisions which have been taken. And if you juxtapose this, the Chinese example, to the South Korean one as well, and if you go back 50 years, when Ghana was becoming independent, for example, about the same time, South Korea was also, they had more or less the same GDP. And of course, we know now where South Korea is, and we see now Ghana is now moving up slightly. But, you know, there is a chasm in terms of salary, in terms of, it's a giant. And they have been able to do this by investing, because why I mention South Korea is that South Korea doesn't have any resources, no minerals, only the human capital. So they have been able to grow because they have invested in the people, they have invested in the ecosystem, innovation, and they have prioritized science over everything else. And we now see that this country is a giant. And also, as we speak, I think South Korea, the government, invest in the space, and I think they invest about 7 to 8% of their GDP, which is also matched by the private sector. And unfortunately, in Africa, we're still struggling to actually invest that 1%, which the African Union asked for. So again, we know what the answer is. We know what the solutions are. So we have to get our act together and pull our resources together and make it happen. There are interesting centers where they are attracting some of the talent. Again, I go back to South Africa. And I also find, for example, a country like Rwanda, which is doing quite well. And why I mention Rwanda? Because it's a country that has been like the phoenix. It's risen after the genocide in 1994, and it's doing quite well in terms of the indicators. Senegal is also doing quite well, because Senegal had been chosen by the center, the CDC and the WHO, to be one of the countries to be producing vaccines very soon. So there are pockets. Of course, Africa is 55 countries. It is not one country like India or China. So there are many layers to the development. And one thing I always say, that Africa is a very rich continent. All the resources. Africa is a continent that has actually underwritten, if I may use the word, the first, second, the third, and now the fourth industrial revolution through the minerals that they have, you know, the rare earth and you name it, it's there. So we should be able to actually pull these together and make it work for us too.
I have a bit of a request from you, ma'am. You know, a lot of these messages that, you know, you're speaking not just to people on the continent, but also people outside of the continent, and this idea of trying to get them back. And a lot of those messages are about, yes, speaking to the head, but also speaking to the heart. If I were to ask you to be the continental spokesperson in this interview and try and speak to people working abroad, professionals, what would your message be to them if you could speak to them directly about the benefits for them of coming back to the continent?
I will speak to these very talented Africans who are, be it in the United States, be anywhere in the developed world, where they're making big contribution. Provide us a little bit of your time. Come and be that role model. Come and actually help that young girl, that young boy, make that child dream. Because if that child dreams big, and again, I quote here President Sirleaf Johnson when she said that you have to dream big and your dreams have to scare you. So these people who are out there, help that child dream big. Make sure that the dream for that children there scare them, because then they will rise to the challenge. And if they are there as a mentor, And if they are there as a role model, I think anything is possible. And I think sometimes it's all that it takes is to have that mentor there, to have that support. So please, let's try and encourage brain circulation and help those and take them by the hand on the continent.
Well, Dr. Amina Gharib-Fakim, that certainly had an effect on this African living abroad. I'm not quite ready to take the first flight back to Cape Town, but I will tell you that's an incredibly effective message, because as anyone who has come from the continent, when you hear that, that does have an effect, doesn't it? Ma'am, thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate your perspectives and your insights.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Thank you. Take care. And that was my conversation with the former president of Mauritius, Amina Gharib-Fakim. It's time for another break, and when we come back, we'll hear from Dr. Nosochi Okeke Ebokwe here in the United States. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're discussing ways to reverse Africa's medical brain drain. The Africa Centers for Disease Control is reportedly exploring ways to entice Africa's expat medical professionals to return to the continent to help African countries prepare for future outbreaks and, of course, other health crises. But what is needed to accomplish this? And what do the medical professionals themselves make of the idea? Earlier, I spoke to Dr. Nosochi Okeke Ebokwe here in the United States.
My name is Dr. Nosochi Okeke Ebokwe, Abomoni Igbo, meaning that I am of Igbo heritage. I'm of Igbo descent, one of the major tribes in Nigeria. Although I was born and raised in the U.S., I was always traveling to Nigeria. My parents pretty much made it a point that I would know where I came from. And one person I do have to thank for that is my mom. She gave me the wonderful opportunity to be raised in the U.S. and have an education at one of the best medical schools in the country, Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. But one thing that was wonderful was watching her own career and seeing how she was able to make contributions to healthcare, not only in the US, but also in Nigeria. She set up her practices here in the US, but there was a point at which she really wanted to make contributions back home to Nigeria. She basically started an audiological center for the Nigerian Armed Forces about 20-something years ago. And she was able to basically pioneer hearing health in Nigeria. From there, she expanded to set up different centers throughout Nigeria. It was important that she give back to Nigeria, and she would do a back and forth. So as I grew up and I saw this, I wanted to do the same thing too. During medical school, especially during your fourth year of medical school, they have these different rotations that you're able to do. So students can pretty much travel to different countries to have an experience practicing medicine in another country. The country that I chose during my fourth year medicine rotation was obviously Nigeria. And I was able to rotate through emergency rooms there, OBGYN clinics there. And there were certain experiences that I had that led me to believe that there are serious challenges with the healthcare system in Nigeria. So in my adult years, I've been going back and forth basically doing a lot of media interviews, media tours, to really just let the Nigerian people know what health issues are impacting them and what they kind of need to be aware of. But I do have to say, as far back as I can remember, even when I would do those clinical rotations that I was telling you about in Nigeria, it was always conflicting knowing that I had to go back to the States. What happens to everyone that is left behind? If it's okay, I'd like to just read an excerpt of something from many years ago, what my experience was in that moment. So I said, my first week at the military hospital, I was allowed to work in the different departments to get a sense of what would be the most interesting to me. The first day I showed up for work, I started immediately rounding with the medicine team. For the most part, medicine rounds were similar to rounding in the States, with the exception of the facilities that we had to use. The medicine inpatient wards were extremely small and crowded, and there were around 25 beds lined up in the space. There was no running electricity or water, and the conditions just seemed unbearable to me. Within the first 15 minutes, I was thoroughly drenched in sweat, bitten by multiple mosquitoes, and just thought that I would collapse at any moment from heat exhaustion. All I could think was, if I'm having such a hard time making it through the first few minutes of rounds, what about the sick patients who must endure these conditions daily? I was told that at this hospital, they did have a generator, but since the cost of the fuel for it was so expensive, they only would put it on during emergency situations. So that's just something that I reported back to the dean after that clinical rotation that I had. It made me feel, honestly, at that point, horrible that people had to actually experience this. I felt for the team taking care of these patients. So when I hear for calls for medical professionals to come back to their country of origin, I think the key thing that I think of is, come back to what exactly? You know, come back to a situation whereby there may be issues with actually receiving the salary that you're supposed to be guaranteed. That's an issue my colleagues that are still practicing in Nigeria tell me about all the time. So who honestly wants to come back to that? We just have to be honest about this. Everyone is seeking out greener pastures. And if you are in an environment whereby the healthcare infrastructure doesn't allow you to actually doctor and take care of your patients, really, what is the selling point? What are you coming back to? What are you coming back for? Even the powers that be, when they have the opportunities to leave Nigeria for quote unquote greener pastures, they leave too. A lot of the powerful and influential people in Nigeria, when they have medical issues or medical problems, guess where they go? They go to the US, they come to the Western world, they go to the UK for their treatment. If the Nigerian healthcare system is not good enough for those leaders, honestly, it shouldn't be good enough for the inhabitants of Nigeria. It should get to a point whereby the healthcare infrastructure is so strong and so good that even our political leaders, our influential figures in Nigeria, stay in Nigeria for their health treatment. It kind of gives a message if your own leadership has to go abroad anytime they have health needs. So until we get to such a point whereby, you know, healthcare is equitable, we have all the resources that are needed, I don't really see it as a realistic selling point to anyone to go back and live your life till thy kingdom come in Nigeria. But back and forth, definitely realistic. Full time, not coming back to the U.S. again, I don't see that happening.
And that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you to all my guests for joining me. And a big thanks to our affiliate stations airing Straight Talk Africa across the continent. And to our audience, I thank you for joining me on radio, television, and online. From our team here in Washington, take good care. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.